right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Yeah, this week's show is about abortion. That's right, we're visiting abortion again. The right to abortion is a basic human right. That's it. That's said, that's done. It's the right of a woman to control her own body. Think about it. If a woman can't make basic decisions about her own body, including the very important decision of whether to have a baby, then she is a slave. Now, we're going to hear two interviews today. At the back end of the show, we'll hear part of an interview I did earlier this year with Sansara Taylor. This was right before the January 22nd anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the court decision that legalized abortion in the U.S. We talk about why there's an abortion rights emergency, why we need an actual revolution to emancipate women, and why people need to act now for abortion rights. Sansara Taylor is an ardent follower of Bob Avakian, a fighter for his leadership in a new synthesis of communism that he's developed and brought forward, and a revolutionary communist herself. She writes for Revolution Newspaper, www.revcom.us, and she is the key initiator of End Pornography and Patriarchy, the Enslavement and Degradation of Women. As I said, this is just part of the interview. The full interview is available at themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, themichaelslateshow.com. And right now, we're going to hear an interview I did with Dawn Porter, the director of the film Trapped, a film that's being released right now, has been showing on HBO, and which tells the story of clinic workers and others who are fighting to keep clinics open. Trapped is the new film by Dawn Porter, and it follows the struggles of clinic workers and lawyers who are on the front lines of a battle to keep abortion safe and legal for millions of women in this country. The film was awarded the U.S. Documentary Special Jury Award for Social Impact Filmmaking at Sundance this year. And let me tell you, folks, it is a film that really will knock you back in your seats. It's just a very powerful film. It really, really brings out not only the need for people to step up and fight to preserve the right to an abortion, but also what it has to do with recognizing and upholding the humanity of women as, you know, a whole big part of the human race. I can't do any of this. And joining us to talk about all this now is Dawn Porter. Dawn is the filmmaker of Trapped, and she's also the filmmaker of an earlier film that was similar in content, which was called Gideon's Army, and that was about the struggles of public defenders to fight for justice for people that never get it in this society, all right? And in a similar vein, this is what Trapped is all about, demanding that the rights of women to humanity and to an abortion, in which all this is concentrated up, are protected, defended, and extended, all right, all over the country. So, Dawn, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I saw your film when it premiered at Sundance, and it was such a, you know, moving piece. I mean, it was one of those things where you're just nailed to your seat and your eyes are nailed to the screen and you're following this through. And the whole thing that got concentrated in there really brought out a lot to me in terms of the kind of situation that one, that women are facing today and that generally people everywhere have to stand up to, the question of whether or not certain sections of people are going to be robbed of their humanity by the functioning of the system or not. And what are we going to do about it in the face of that? And I thought this film was a great contribution to saying we can't step back and just sit down and go to sleep when all this is happening. So I wanted to ask you the compulsion you faced to make this film. What made you make this film?
You know, I had spent a lot of time in the South when I was making my first film, Gideon's Army, about public defenders. And I was making a film called Spies of Mississippi that was on PBS. And that film was about how the Mississippi state government infiltrated the NAACP. And, you know, people understand how the federal government did that in the South during the civil rights era. But the story of how the state government targeted civil rights workers and leaders was less well known. So I was kind of in that mindset of thinking about how government can, you know, is not always as equal and is not always the benevolent help that we expect. And so I read in the newspaper, I was in Jackson, Mississippi, and I read in the newspaper that there was one abortion clinic left. And I just couldn't believe it. And it was kind of what you're speaking to about my own feeling of I have been complacent. I'm a pro-choice person. I'm a person who's politically aware. How could I not see this happening? And then I started really thinking about this is not just the South. This is a systemic issue. So I really wanted to try and show how it could possibly be the case that a federally protected constitutional right, which is the right to bodily integrity and 14th Amendment protections, how could legislators at the state level be enacting legislation that directly influenced and could take that away? So that's kind of the approach I had to the film. So it's very much, for me, a question of what is the proper functioning of any governmental system.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that you did, and this is extremely important for people who are going to see the film or who are debating whether they should see the film, the point that you did that really struck me very heavily was you laid out from the very beginning what the situation is today, both what are the clinics facing and what are the stakes involved?
Yeah, you know, it's really fascinating. I mean, in a horrifying way, if you believe in access, in abortion access. But since 2010, so for the last five, now going on 5.5 years, state legislatures across America have passed what are known as trap laws. So that's targeted regulation of abortion providers. So they're laws that regulate the width of a hallway or how many parking spaces you can have. Or some of the most effective laws are that a doctor who provides abortion has to have admitting privileges to a local hospital. So that sounds like it's good for health and safety, but what happens is the local hospitals will not grant those privileges. So you get into this Kafkaesque catch-22, where the state requires you to have something that's impossible to get. And as a result, clinics have started to close. So we have, I believe it's five states in America right now where there's only one abortion clinic in the entire state. Mm. We have in Texas where more than half of the clinics have closed, and that's even though parts of the Texas trap laws have been stayed pending a Supreme Court decision in a case that's going to be argued in March and decided in June. So you have had this radical and extreme closing of abortion clinics because of these types of laws. They've been remarkably effective. I think most people understand the dangers that abortion providers face, the physical dangers from people who would kill them. But the most effective strategy for closing clinics has not really been the extremists, it has been these legislators. And so that's what the movie follows. Clinic owners who are trying to comply with the laws with varying degrees of success.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things it brings out, too, and these laws were actually specifically written to, it seemed to me, they were specifically written to, in fact, ensure that the clinics would not be able to function. I mean, even there's some scenes in the film where things are mandated that can't possibly be done, or it says, see this section here, and you go there, and there's no section there explaining
the
what
section,
you can,
right.
Yeah, or the thing about the doctors, and what, you know, there's a whole thing. It's just, it was a very moving moment where there was a young woman who had been, I think she was gang raped, and she was she was just a kid, and she,
you know, 13.
And because of these trap laws, that she was not able to actually, you know, what it required would mean that she would not really be able to get the abortion that she really needed, you know,
that's right.
At that moment.
Well, I think, you know, and it's really important to think about how the laws have progressed over time. And also to think about who's behind the law. So there's a group, Americans United for Life, and they have been dedicated to overturning Roe v. Wade since Roe v. Wade. So they, for example, paid for the lawyers that argued the Planned Parenthood versus Casey decision in 1993. When Roe v. Wade was decided, the Supreme Court struck a bright line test. It said you cannot regulate abortion at the state level in the first trimester. What 20 years later in the Casey decision, the Supreme Court, with these lawyers paid for by Americans United for Life, were successful in securing the ability of states to regulate abortion clinics for quote-unquote health and safety. Well, if you don't define what health and safety means, and health and safety is traditionally something that's governed by state governments, it's caused a lot of chaos. And that's, you're seeing the effect of that decision combined with, in 2008, state governments being overtaken by very conservative Tea Party and very conservative activists. So that 1-2 combination has led to passing all of these laws that have been, you know, the Americans United for Life drafts model legislation. They try it out in one state. If it works there, that state will pass it on to another state. And so you see this slow erosion of the protections and access to abortion services. So I feel like it's definitely a film about abortion access, but it's also a film about what happens when you have a group like this targeted at a social issue and how can they effectively use the government process to achieve their ends. So one of the things I was trying to do is say, this sounds like it's complicated and it's hard to follow. What the results are not that hard to follow. You have situations where thousands, tens of thousands of women are not receiving an abortion that they would otherwise elect. And often with pretty, you know, heartbreaking results. And that's happening in far too many places.
Mm-hmm. You know, just to add on to that, the one scene, I can't remember the man's name, but he was the chief justice of in Alabama?
His name is Roy Moore,
right.
The chief justice of the state Supreme Court.
Yeah, and he also happens to be the biggest anti-abortion guy in the world, apparently. And
he is.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
He has a foundation that was dedicated to writing anti-abortion legislation, to writing anti-gay legislation. He's one of the holdouts who's still refusing to sanction gay marriage, even in the face of a Supreme Court decision. And so you have a situation where the elected chief justice of the state Supreme Court, the person who is charged with enforcing the laws of the land, is avowedly anti-choice and has a foundation that is dedicated to overturning the laws that he's supposed to enforce. So it's just a very bizarre situation. And if people are not, you know, I always say I kind of aim this movie, and Vivian's Army as well, at people like me. You know, it's not that we don't care about these issues, but we think that they're taken care of. And they're really not. And it's really up to people who, you know, have beliefs that are not in keeping with a very conservative right-wing agenda. It's up to all of us to make sure we understand what's happening in our states, particularly at a state and local level. This is not a Southern issue or Southern problem. It is a nationwide problem.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk about, too, is, you know, people... We've talked a little bit about this, the sort of the mechanical things going on and the requirements they set out to for an abortion clinic to have, whether it's the nurse anesthetist or whether it's, you know, certain amount of drugs on hand that are never going to be used because there's never that kind of, there's never a call for them. But it's wearing the clinics down. It's you know, taking their money. It's trying to drive them into bankruptcy or just not being able to function.
Yeah.
But there's also the question of the doctors, which I found extremely powerful in your film, because you have these doctors that you present as, you know, who are doing this because they really, really believe in it. And yet this whole thing that's going after them in terms of needing admitting privileges in a hospital before they can be allowed to perform an abortion in a clinic, this is very heavy stuff, because it's not like these people are incompetent doctors. It's not like they're, you know, or even that, you know, they're in a situation apparently where the need to get anybody admitted is very, very slight, you know? Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, it's really, once you start to understand the mechanics of how this works, it's really pretty, it's kind of horrifying. So, you know, first we had a situation where doctors were being killed, you know, clinics were bombed. So you have a number of doctors who are saying, quite legitimately, I'm not willing to take that risk to practice my profession. So they stop providing abortion services. Then you have a lot of pressure and harassment from states that are hostile to abortion. So you have a situation where doctors in local communities that are anti-choice stop providing services. So the only way in the last 5 years in particular that abortion clinics, particularly in southern states or states like South Dakota, out kind of in the heartland, some heartland states, the only way that you have doctors who can provide abortions is if people are flying in. So you have a situation where, like in Alabama, there are 5 doctors who will provide abortions in the whole state. None of them live full-time in the state. But because of that, you have the situation where to schedule a doctor at a clinic is very, very challenging. So you have people flying all over to provide services. So Dr. Parker, who's followed in my film, flies to three different clinics in Alabama. Then he goes to Mississippi. He goes to Georgia. And so he's in this constant loop of providing where there's no local folks. And then on top of that, you have a situation. So while we were at Sundance, while on the day after the film premiered, the clinic in Tuscaloosa, which is one of the clinics that Dr. Parker works at and is one of the clinics we featured in the film, the health department came in for a quote-unquote surprise inspection. And so while the clinic owner was out of town and Dr. Parker was out of town, the staff is there in the clinic. The health department says, we want to see all of your records. We want to see all of your admissions. The clinic's only been open for 4 months. So clinics are used to, everybody is open to health and safety, making sure everything's up to par. But what they usually do is this leads to a situation where they find a quote-unquote deficiency. So, for example, during this surprise inspection, they said there was not a cap on a bottle of medicine. So it's those kinds of things. And it's this kind of like constant, imagine running your business with somebody dropping in for surprise inspections and kind of picking away at every procedure. So you have to have a physician and a clinic owner that's not only willing to work in a hospital environment, but is also really overregulated. And I'd love for people to think about, we have a healthcare crisis in this country where we don't have enough physicians supplying services, particularly to poor people. And a lot of these public clinics are frequented by poor people. If you have insurance, you can go to your own doctor and have an abortion, or you can leave the state and go someplace where it's not quite so controversial. If you don't have the means to leave your state or your local place, you go to one of these public clinics. And these are the people that are being the most heavily hit by this over-regulation. So, you know, it really makes you think about who is bearing the brunt of these regulations. Who are those people?
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dawn Porter. Dawn is the director of a fantastic new film that I saw at Sundance recently, and the film is called Trapped, and it's about the trap laws that are aimed at shutting down abortion clinics all throughout the South, and in particular, ending the right to abortion for women everywhere in this country. All right, that's what it's all about. And Dawn has made a very powerful and inspiring documentary about the struggle of abortion providers and people working in those clinics to keep them open and to make sure that women everywhere have the right to an abortion. You know, just back on the sort of an extension of that, going back to the point about the admitting privileges at hospitals, this is something that people might think, well, what's wrong with that? Right. Of course you should have admitting privileges at hospitals. If something happens there, you're going to have to, you know, you have to send somebody to a hospital. You're going to have to be able to take care of them. And what happens if you're not allowed to go into the hospital? So I think people might think that this is a reasonable, basically, requirement. And what would you say about that?
That's exactly right. You've really kind of hit it on the head there, because what happens is it sounds on its face like it's a reasonable, you know, regulation. But if you think about it, it doesn't really make any sense. You have women who are traveling often because there are so few clinics in so many places in the South and in concentrated areas. You have women who are often traveling 25, 50, 100, 150 miles or more to get to a clinic. If that person had an emergency after they got home, they wouldn't go drive 3 hours and have their doctor who performed the procedure admit them to the emergency room. You go to the emergency room where you are located. So the reality is less than 1% of abortion procedures performed in outpatient clinics require a hospital emergency admission. And if something required a hospital emergency admission, no hospital is going to refuse a patient. So it's not a question of whether the patient's going to be treated. And just like any other emergency, if you had an emergency at your dentist office, your dentist doesn't admit you to the hospital. You go to the emergency room and you're treated and you explain what happened. So it's not, the American Medical Association, the American College of Gynecologists and Obstetricians all have come out against these regulations as not being medically necessary. And yet these regulations are required for physicians to perform abortions. So that is going to be one of the issues squarely before the Supreme Court. Is that requirement an undue burden on women seeking abortions such that it violates a constitutional right to privacy and right to bodily integrity embodied in the 14th Amendment, and so is illegitimate. So it's going to be a really important case.
Yeah, definitely. Now, tell me this. I want to talk a little bit more about the staff, that from the doctors to the staff people in it, because that was one of the most inspiring things in the film, that to see both the camaraderie, but the dedication and the determination that people were not going to allow this to stop them. And it was very, very moving to see this, including the one woman who has kept her clinic open, and even though she hasn't been able to bring patients in because of some violation that they accused her of. I'd like to talk a little bit about this. And one thing I thought, even just to start it, is because is this thing about like the booklet, the medical warnings, you know, the Did You Know booklet.
The Did You Know.
Yeah, because I thought that captured a certain thing about the sort of the character of the staff, and they're in your face. You're not going to, you know, you're not going to get away with this. Tell people about this. Did You Know?
You know, when you're a documentary filmmaker, one of the things you look for is kind of that strength. You know, showing people who are everyday kind of unsung, you know, the word heroes is thrown around too often, but really each of the characters in the film are people who live in the communities, you know, have lived there for either all their lives or for many, many years. And they are not allowing, you know, a hostile kind of conservative religious environment to scare them away. And it was really moving to me to see how much they are. They are from those communities, and they are serving the women in the communities. And I'll tell you, you know, something that happened kind of off camera. A lot of cool stuff happens off camera, which kills us documentary people. But June Ayers, who owns the clinic in Montgomery, Alabama, and she is a two-time cancer survivor. She's been like on the verge of bankruptcy, you know, multiple times. And we were filming and it had kind of a rough day. And I said to her, do you ever think about just leaving? And she looked at me and she goes, never. She's like, I'm not going to leave my ladies. And she looked at me and she said, you know what? I'm Southern too. And they don't get to decide who a Southerner is or who a strong woman is. And I think for her and for the other clinic providers, it's very important that they be from their communities and that they look their community members in the eyes and say, I belong here too. And that's, you know, the kind of dedication that keeps people. They also understand very clearly that there are not people waiting in line to open abortion clinics behind them. It's a business that is so hyper-regulated, has so many difficulties existing, that it's not something that people are lining up to go open. So they are really, when we think about the right to choose, the right doesn't mean very much if there aren't any clinics. And these people, men and women, are keeping those clinics open. And there's really just a few of them. So there have been some really fantastic movies about abortion clinics, abortion services. After Tiller is a beautiful, beautiful movie about late-term abortion, about the four remaining late-term abortion people. Mm-hmm. But the abortion access in After Tiller is less than 5% of all the abortions performed in America. So these handful of people, these, you know, three independent clinic owners, are keeping abortion access open for the other 95% of people who are facing that choice. And, you know, I think it was really important to me to show these are Southerners too. These are people who you might not expect, and they're funny. And they're religious, and they're just regular people, but they have this will that I found really compelling. And one of the things I hope to achieve in the film is to show that, show that there's a lot of ways to be strong.
Yeah, definitely. And I thought one of the ways, that's why I was so attracted to this thing of even just giving people a hint about what this Did You Know booklet was, because there was a sense of humor behind it, but also deadly serious, because there was a dangerous thing that was being put out in terms of scaring women about what could happen, what might happen. You know, you could have, you know, you could drop dead if I touch you or something, you know, this
well,
kind
you
of
have,
thing.
Yeah, you have, so for June Ayers Clinic, you have, you know, in Mississippi, the informational booklet required, mandated to be published by the state, requires an abortion provider to say that abortion could cause breast cancer. So there's medically inaccurate information, and then all of these scare tactics. You know, we started the film with a young woman who says, what if I get the pelvic inflammatory disease? Am I going to lose my ability to have children? And so you have people who are coming in and are terrified about a procedure that is one of the safest outpatient medical procedures that is performed. And so there's a huge disconnect between the amount of attention and the kind of information and the way that it's presented that is given in these state-mandated books. The state requires these books to be handed out. And I think that's also, you know, it's an issue for medicine. I mean, we should be educating people with accurate facts. You can oppose abortion on what your version of morality is, but I find it really objectionable to be bullying and to be giving people medically inaccurate information that causes them unnecessary additional stress over something that is already very stressful. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, wouldn't it be fun to have an abortion today? I don't know anybody, you know, I've seen many, many people over the last 4 years. And so it's really kind of an abusive thing to do to folks. It doesn't make them change their minds. It just makes them worry more. Mm-hmm. And that makes me really angry. Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that came out in your film, too, which I thought is linked to what you're just talking about, is that the more the other side gets away with this kind of bull that they're running out on things, and the intimidation and the actual use of the legal system to actually do away with abortion to the extent they can do it now, and then obviously with the goal of doing away with it once and for all. You know, you think about this, and what actually ends up happening, this was referred to in the film as well, is that actually what ends up happening is self-induced abortions are on the rise. And those are what's actually very dangerous. And it's a direct product of this question of banning the right to an abortion in other circumstances.
That's absolutely right. The University of Texas did a study that estimates between 100,000 and 240,000 Texan women, not women across the country, but women in Texas, have attempted to self-abort since more than half of the clinics in the state have been closed. So we're going from a situation where you have medically trained professionals performing a very safe procedure in a regulated environment to closing those facilities, cutting off that access, and women are not any less desperate to end their pregnancies. And so you see people taking, you know, matters into their own hands. And that was the situation pre-Roe v. Wade. And it's a very much a concern that in a lot of states, we're kind of going back to that pre-Roe reality.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that whole point there, too, about denying the humanity of the women who are seeking abortions, and the women who aren't seeking abortions but might need them at some point in the future, just should have the right to have it be there. What I really like about the film is that across the board, there's no hesitation, there's no defensiveness about whether or not what abortion is, that it's a much-needed and legitimate medical procedure and essential part of women's health care. This is extremely important. I thought that this came out a lot with Dr. Parker in particular, and he talked about how providing abortions was a matter of his humanity and even more so recognizing the humanity of women. I thought that was an extremely important point that, you know, that the film carried out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's an extraordinary person, and it has been really added a lot to my life to know him. You know, he didn't provide abortions for the first 12 years of his career. He was raised in the South, in Alabama, very poor, in a very religious household. And he, when he went to medical school and became an OBGYN, he, you know, did not perform abortions. And then he saw women dying, women injured, maimed out of, you know, lack of prenatal health care. And he said, I think that this is part of humanity. I provide a medical service that I'm trained to do. And he really hasn't looked back. And I think one of the things I really hope happens as people see the film and talk about it is the stigma around abortion is lessened. 1 in 3 American women will have an abortion before she's 45. That means 33% of our population is undergoing this service. And I definitely saw throughout our screenings at Sundance, one of the unanticipated, really lovely things that happened was people started talking about their experiences and feeling not quite so alone. And I think my goal is that we would talk about this for what it is. It's healthcare, and leave people's morality to people. You know, I can't decide your morality. You don't decide mine. But we can do something that we know is you know, kind of a medically and sometimes, you know, needed or desired procedure. I trust women enough to make decisions about their own lives. I can't make a decision for somebody else, and I don't choose to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, one thing, and I have just two more questions, and this one will be quick here, but maybe, I don't know, maybe we'll answer it lengthily, but my thing here is that, you know, I can't help, I do think this, when I think about the right to an abortion and the need for women to have free, open access to getting an abortion, to any kind of health care that they need, and I think about this, if you're denying that to a woman, you're actually denying her any control over her body. And that, to me, is the equivalent to, or it's a form of enslavement. It's a form of slavery. If you're not allowed to actually control your body, what the hell is it that you are in society, you know?
That's right. What can you control? Mm-hmm. You know, one of the most like profound and fundamentally important decisions for any woman and for her partner, for her family, is whether and when to become a parent. And to force somebody into that situation, and, you know, I think it's not extreme to think back to that 13-year-old, you know, who's gang raped. Should she be forced to bear a child? You know, anyone who's had a child knows that it's a life-altering moment. And it seems to me just to be completely without question that that's somebody's right to decide for themselves. So it's just hard to imagine how anyone could think it's not.
Mm-hmm. All right, one last question, Dawn. So what's up with the film now? What's going to happen with this?
We came kind of roaring out of Sundance, and we were so thrilled and gratified by the reception. And we are now taking the film around to film festivals and also to community screenings. So if people visit trapdocumentary.com, you can arrange for a screening in your local community. And then we are opening theatrically in theaters in selected cities March 4th, and then continuing to open in additional cities March 11th. So we're trying to get as many screenings as possible in order to have as much conversation as possible. We're in an election year where this should be a big topic of discussion, access to abortion. And on March 2nd, the Supreme Court will hear a challenge to the TRAP laws. So the title of the film comes from TRAP laws. So the Supreme Court will hear an argument. It will be argued by the Center for Reproductive Rights, and a decision on whether these laws that have closed, you know, so many clinics across the country will be able to stand is expected in June. So between now and June, we are trying to have as many screenings as possible in as many communities as possible. So if people care about these issues, we hope they will come out, support those screenings, and tell people this is an issue that matters to you.
Mm-hmm. So it's trappeddocumentary.com that people should go to?
Yes.
Okay, great. Dawn Porter, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate
it. And we'll stay in touch just so I can keep up on what's going on and chip in, okay?
Thank you.
All right, Dawn, take care now.
Okay.
Bye. All right, we've just been talking with Dawn Porter, the director of the film Trapped, and we've been talking about the fight to keep abortion clinics and abortion services open and available, not only in the South, but everywhere across the country, and all the attempts to crush that. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break, and we'll be right back with Sansara Taylor. Nina Simone with I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free. We're going to go into the excerpt of the interview I did with Sansara Taylor back in January. Remember now, you can hear the entire interview at my website, which is at themichaelslateshow.com. I'm really pleased to welcome to the show today Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper, RevCom.us, and an initiator of End Pornography and Patriarchy, the Enslavement and Degradation of Women. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, you too. Let's talk about this. I was just saying the anniversary of Roe v. Wade decision is coming up. And as usual, there's all kinds of anti-abortion fanatics and fascists mobilizing against the right to an abortion. There's a certain sense it's clear that the anti-abortion fascists are clear on what's at stake here. But I'm not so sure it's at the same level of clarity on the part of the people who think that abortion is an essential right that women must have. So let's start off with, why is it important that people don't just sort of ho-hum this upcoming thing around Roe v. Wade, that people actually get into it and take this up and fight it out?
Well, I'm glad you asked. I think people know that there have been some anti-abortion laws passed. They know that maybe there's been some acts of violence here and there against abortion clinics. But really, I think that people have no real idea the scale and the scope of an emergency facing abortion rights. It's an intense and extreme emergency, and it's a largely invisible emergency. It's one that's felt by millions and millions of women, huge numbers of women. People should know this country is seeing an escalation because there have been so many abortion clinics forced to close because of medically unnecessary fascist anti-woman laws. There have been 100,000 women in Texas alone have self-induced abortions, attempted to induce their own abortions because they can't access a clinic. The Planned Parenthood, as you cited in Colorado, that was shot up, held hostage. And of course, the media treated it like it was just another instance of gun violence. This was anti-abortion terrorism. There are doctors being stalked across this country. Half the clinics in the country have people in the clinics who've experienced targeted harassment and stalking and terrorism. That means they've been followed home. Their children have been harassed at school. They've been hunted. They've been sent hate mail. Their parents in nursing homes have been harassed. This is targeted, widespread terrorism against abortion providers. It's doubled in the last 4 years, the rate at which that's happening. It's an abortion rights emergency. It's the young woman, Anna Yoka, who's in Tennessee. Tennessee is a state where you have a 48-hour waiting period. It's one of many states with a waiting period. So you don't have to just go to the clinic once to get an abortion. You have to make the trip more than once. You have to go. You have to wait 2 days. You have to go again. You have to take the time off of work twice. You have to have the money to travel because so many clinics are closed down. A lot of women have to travel great distances. If you have another child, you have to find childcare. If you're in an abusive marriage, you have to, or a relationship, you have to figure out how to get out of the house. You have to come up with the money to make the trip, and you have to make the trip twice. There's all kinds of hurdles and restrictions. So Anna Yucca was one of many people in this country who attempted to self-induce. She allegedly attempted to self-induce an abortion. This was recently. She used a coat hanger. This is not 40 years ago. This is not 60 years ago before Roe v. Wade. She used a coat hanger and ended up bleeding profusely, was scared for her life and went to the hospital. And instead of being treated like a woman who needed help terminating an unwanted pregnancy and should have every right to do so, the hospital intervened and removed the fetus and put it on life support and forced Anna Yoka to become a mother against her will, first of all. Then they turn her over to the state and they get the police and the state involved. Anna Yoka has been charged with first degree attempted murder. She's sitting in prison. She's sitting in jail. She is somebody who was almost murdered by the state and all the anti-abortion laws that have been passed, but instead she is being charged with murder. And so Anna Yoka, she represents the lives of millions of women. And she's being made an example of, frankly. A legal precedent is being set, but an example. It's kind of like an honor killing. You kill one woman in a very public way, and you send a chill to every other woman. If you go to the hospital, if you can't find help to get a safe legal abortion and you take matters into your own hands, you better not show up at the hospital, even if you're bleeding to death, because you could end up in jail. This is what's being done right now. And I think that the quote from Baba Bacon is very germane, because he makes the point, unbelievable as it may seem, there are still people who want to remove from women the right to decide for themselves whether and when they will have a child. They want to force women to have children against their will. And it is a form of enslaving women, to the dictates of a male supremacist patriarchal system in society. It's a form of forcing women into a subordinate place to foreclose their lives, to have children against their will, to make their entire lives contorted and deformed. Look, having a child, if you want to have a child, can be wonderful. But if you don't want one, you're having your life foreclosed and deformed and funneled into being a breeder against your will. And in the context of a male supremacist, male-dominated society, where you're treated with disrespect, where you don't have as many options, where the burden lands on the woman by herself with tremendous shame and very few resources. And I think this is the objective. This is the objective of the anti-abortion movement.
Let me ask you this, because that's an extremely important point in what you've just been saying. Because, look, for a lot of people, there's the thing where people will say, okay, you know, yeah, but these are a handful of fanatics out there. This, what does this have to do with the whole society? There's a lot more of us rational thinking, kind-hearted, good-willed people who are saying, no, we're not going to allow women to be pushed into virtual slavery. At the same time, it's sort of like people are looking at it as it's still really, I mean, that's treating it as it's some kind of like wacky leftover from a bygone era or an embarrassing blemish on what pretty much is an overall cool situation for women today. After all, we're not forcing them to be one of a harem of nine wives and the rest of this stuff, and they have no rights at all. Let's talk about that, because it's much heavier than I think what people initially and spontaneously just say, yeah, okay, it's important what you're saying, but it's not all that.
Yeah, I think I like the way you asked. Even people say, well, we wouldn't allow that. Well, first of all, wake up. You are allowing it. It is happening. I didn't make up the story I just told. I didn't make up the Planned Parenthood shooting or the stalking that's going on or the terrorism against all these other doctors. These are not minor phenomena, but they're also not isolated. I think you're right. And this is the way it gets portrayed in the mainstream bourgeois ruling class media, and then the way it gets portrayed by the Democrats, too, constantly. We're making progress for women. Women have basically achieved their equality. There's a few leftover things. There's these out-of-touch Republicans. They're trying to take women's rights away, but they're out of touch. First of all, they're succeeding, first of all. But second of all, it's not the case that women are achieving all-around emancipation, except for a few leftovers who are going for abortion rights. We live in a society where women are, they're stalked, they're beaten, they're raped at phenomenal levels, where it's more dangerous for a woman to be in her own home or a young girl to be in her own home than it is to be on the street, where domestic abuse is just rampant, where women are still, look, the culture, the mainstream culture, you click on the radio. I can say the word bitches on the air. There's all kinds of words I can't say, but I can say bitches. You could say hoes. You can play it in the music. You can bop your head to it. Kids are learning these words and learning to see women as such before they even know what they mean. Girls are learning this. You have the whole culture is saturated with violent, degrading, cruel pornography that's training boys and men to see the degradation and torture of women as sexually titillating. And that's coloring and shaping the way real men treat real women. And it's not a, these are not minor phenomena. These are major parts. They're cornerstones of the culture. And it goes along with the brutality. It goes along with the way that women are trafficked around the world, all over the world, including into this country and including girls in this country being pimped out at the age 12, 13 years old, and there being men who will purchase them. And not a, again, not a minor phenomenon, a major phenomenon. So it's all that. And then it's just the way that girls are, girls and women are bombarded with the message that their value is derived from being somehow a prized sex object or the smartest or the sexiest or the best catch for a man. And so their value, they starve themselves, they learn to hate themselves, they learn to play dumb, they learn to cut themselves. There's all kinds of ways that they internalize the worthlessness that this society tells them that they aren't worth anything unless they are a sex object or a breeder or somehow desired by men. And this is the world we live in. And it has a body count, and it has a psychic toll, and it has a trauma toll, and it affects every woman, and including the young women. I'll just say, including the women, young women and otherwise, who are told they've made it. They go to college. They have a career. They have a future. They're told you can achieve, too. You could be just as cutthroat and just as top dog as a man, which itself has problems. But at the same time, you still have to be that sexual performer. You still have to be the perfect household keeper. You still have to be. It's you're told you can have it all, but really what you're being told is now you have to conform to every sexual standard, every standard of what women, a subordinated woman is supposed to be. You're supposed to conform to all of them at once. We don't live in a liberated society. This is a patriarchal, male-dominated society, and we need a revolution. It's one of the many reasons, the level of degradation and disrespect and harm caused to women is one of the many reasons, but it's reason enough by itself that this whole society, this whole system needs to be done away with, because it's 43 years after Roe v. Wade, and women are being killed to go get abortions. They're being imprisoned for that. We're going backwards. we need a revolution. We need a different society, a different world.
Well, let me first remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor, a writer for Revolution newspaper, RevCom.us, and an initiator of End Pornography and Patriarchy, the Enslavement and Degradation of Women. Now, Sansara, what you're laying out, and that point about particularly this point about we need a revolution, I mean, when you think about this, even for people who recognize a substantial part of what you've been laying out about the situation of women, there is this point that's really, really just, I think, weighs heavily on people. You look at this and it's like, well, what the hell can we do about it? You know, there's limited room to move. There's, you know, I know people look at this and they say, I do everything I can. You're advocating, you just said revolution is what's necessary for this. And I don't think that's something that people go, oh, yeah. I think we really got to get into and explain some of that. Why is revolution necessary and what? What are you talking about here?
By revolution, people need to look at RevCom.us. They need to go and check out the leadership of Bob Abakan. He's somebody who has been fighting for revolution, leading a revolutionary struggle in this country, but also creating a new foundation, a new theoretical framework for revolution and the emancipation of humanity all over the world, summing up previous revolutions and what has been accomplished and what can be accomplished. But one of the things he really hammers at is that, and he's correct in this, and this is at the foundation of a lot of the problems that then he's put himself to, is that he's recognized that as long as you have the economic system and the culture and the structures and the relations among people that flow from and are enforced by capitalism and imperialism, and the state that governs that and the laws that enforce it and the police that enforce it and the culture that reinforces it, as long as you have that, you can fight, you can resist, you can make some changes, but you will never get free. There'll be changes on a spectrum, and they'll be important, but they keep getting undermined, and we see that. We see that everything the 60s accomplished is being cut back and then some, you know, reversed and with revenge involved. And he's made the point, you need to clear it away. You need to bring the system down, and you need to build a new revolutionary state power. You need to build a socialist state heading towards a communist world, and that is materially possible. And it's much more realistic. It's much more realistic than reforming this system to be something that it can't be. And if that's true, which it is, then you need to put yourself to the problems involved in making that kind of revolution. And how do we prepare people? How do we prepare the grounds? How do we bring forward and hasten the development of a situation where millions can be led to go all out to fight to bring this system down and build a new society and a new state? How would such a struggle be won? And what would a new society and new state power look like? And this is something Bob Abakan has taken responsibility for. And the scope of all of what that means, it goes beyond what you and I can get into, and even in a short interview. But it's at RevCom.us, and BA has done the work, including leading and developing a constitution for the new Socialist Republic of North America that lays out how we could do, starting day one, how we could actually build an economy and a state and a culture where, first of all, among other things, women have access, unstigmatized, unrestricted access to birth control and abortion, so that they can actually control for themselves when and whether they're going to have children, so they can be full human beings and viewed as such, where things like the rampant, violent, degrading, dehumanizing pornography, that's not a cornerstone of the culture. That's going to be shut down, not through puritanism, not through suppressing all expressions of sex. And in fact, we're going to take on religion too, and all the social mores and stigma and shame on women's bodies and sexuality that comes with that. We're going to take on all of that so that women will be viewed as full human beings, including in the sexual realm and sexual liberation, but also including every other realm that women are locked out of in this society. And those are just some of the dimensions in the education system, in the culture, and in the laws that will be given the backing of the state. In the Constitution, you go through, people will have the right to eat. We're not going to degrade and despoil the environment. The police will not be marauding and terrorizing and brutalizing poor and oppressed people. We'll be overcoming white supremacy and oppression. So these are all, you know, they're laid out in great detail. And a lot of work was done here. And this is, you can find it at RevCom.us, but this is real. And BA, Bob Abakan, has been leading this. And this is real. And this is something everybody, if you really want to end slavery in every form, if you want a different world, you have to get into this leadership. You have to actually, if we don't make a revolution, humanity will continue to be ground up the way it is today.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, you've made this point about we need to make a revolution. Now, this is sort of where I think actually we need to sort of hook up with the other thing, too, because, okay, you're saying we need to have this revolution. What are you also saying? And then you're also saying, and we need to fight this assault on women, this stuff around Roe v. Wade and all the other ways that the assault on women comes down, but especially in relation to the abortion rights and the assault on Roe v. Wade. What's the connection there? I mean, you're talking about to people, you're saying, look, really, we need a revolution if we're ever going to resolve any of this. And I think people are going to say, okay, well, then what about, why is it so important to take this other stuff up?
Well, I think revolution, like I said before, it's not a passive affair. We're not sitting back saying, well, we don't want to get our hands dirty with the messiness of this distasteful system, so we'll wait for the revolution. No, this system is a horror. It's a mess. It's a nightmare for humanity, all parts of its functioning. We need a revolution. We need a different system. And to get there, people need to fight back today. We need to get into the theory and the leadership. We need to get organized for a revolution, and we need to fight the power on that foundation and unite with people coming from whatever perspective you're coming from. If you recognize that it's in the DNA of this system of capitalism and imperialism for women to be treated as less than fully human, to be oppressed and degraded and controlled through the patriarchal family, to be denied their basic reproductive rights, to be shamed and stigmatized for their sexuality and their sexual desires. If you recognize that that is built into the foundation of this system, then you recognize even more than anybody why you can't rely on this system to beat back these attacks, and you have to rely on the people themselves to stand up and fight against it. And right now there are millions and millions of people, most of them are not aware of it, because the emergency facing abortion is so invisible. It is so unspoken. It is so covered over. It is so played down, including by the very people that people have been trained to look to protect them on this front. The Democratic Party and other so-called leaders in the so-called women's movement are playing this emergency down so people don't know. But the fact is, millions and millions of people are going to be and are already being affected by this assault on abortion rights. And those are people who can be aroused and awakened to the need to stand up and fight back against this, but only if we tell them the truth, that like the quote from Bob Avakian that you began with, the fight over abortion has never been about babies. It's about controlling women. And if people understand what's at stake and we get out there with the truth that women are not incubators, women are not breeders, fetuses are not babies, abortion is not murder, and this needs to be resisted, we can actually lead people, hundreds, thousands, and ultimately millions, to stand up and fight back against this and to change ourselves, to beat back these attacks, and actually create much more favorable conditions for an actual revolution. So those things are of a piece.
Mm-hmm. You know, and one of the things, and right now, okay, look, you've opened up a whole lot of other issues and arguments and all this other stuff, objections to what you put forward, all this kind of stuff. It's sort of like you are saying, I mean, this is one of the things, I know somebody was asking me this the other day. They kind of said, all right, well, look, you're talking about, you're saying that, well, none of this stuff around the oppression of women, for instance, can be resolved under capitalism. And yet at the same time, you're telling me to fight against this so that we can push back some of the attacks. And they were saying, are you using this as a game to get me into the revolution scene? Or is it real that you can, that there's both a necessity and a possibility of pushing some things back, but it's not going to solve the problem? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think there's no game involved in revolution. And there's no trick going on. I think we should be very honest with people. It's going to take a revolution to end patriarchy. It's going to take a communist revolution. It's going to take the kind of revolution that Bob Avakian has re-envisioned, that communism. Because he's re-envisioned communism, including in significant dimension in how it understands and relates to and takes up the fight for women's liberation as a cornerstone and a driving force, actually, in the emancipation of all humanity. And that's the truth. And if you care about liberation, you have to do the work. You have to get into what Bob Avakian has done on this question. He wrote a pamphlet, a compendium was put together that pulls together some of his many writings on the oppression and liberation of women, called Bob Avakian on the Liberation of Women and the Emancipation of Humanity. And people should read it. People should read the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic. People should get into what he's done and evaluate, is this true or not true? Is there any other way to solve these problems? And the solutions that Bob Avakian has fought for and brought forward, and the active leadership he's giving to the movement for revolution, if this is taken up and fought for, where will it lead? And people should get into that. At the same time, we do need to fight. And Avakian has stressed this as well, and he's given a lot of leadership. Frankly, I've been fighting I've been a leader in the fight for abortion rights for two decades now. All of that has been guided by and led by the active and ongoing leadership of Avakian that he's been providing. So we've been fighting very actively on this. But I think this thing, it's a real emergency. We're not making that up either. Google Anna Yucca. Google the 100,000 people who are self-induced in Texas. Google the fact that every single week and a half in this country, an abortion clinic is forced to close. And then think about what it means for women to experience a late period, to start to get worried that their period is not coming, that they may be pregnant, and the whole world comes crashing down on them. And they're told there's nobody they can talk to because they've done something wrong. They're 15 years old and they think they're committing a sin, and their mother and their grandmother and their priest, all they're afraid to tell them, or if they tell them, they're going to make the girl have a child. Think about what it means for millions of women who are heaped with this stigma and shame, whose lives are foreclosed, and who then, even if they find their way through that and they make it to a clinic, or they try to go to a clinic, they have all these obstacles. They have people hurling insults and screaming at them on the way into the clinic. So they have people blocking their access, making it so that they have to travel too far or raise too much money. Think about the reality of that and tell yourself, ask yourself, does this need to be fought or should this be accepted? Mm-hmm. And right now it needs to be fought. It needs to be fought by everybody. Everybody who cares about this should get into the revolution. But as you do, and wherever you're at in that, this needs to be fought now. And ask yourself this. When in the history of this country was any advance made for the oppressed, whether it be Black people during the civil rights struggle or the Black liberation struggle, whether it be women and the way that the right to abortion was won in the first place, whether it be any other section of oppressed people, those who wanted to stand up against the wars for empire that this country has waged, when has anything been accomplished without people stepping out of their comfort zone and going into the streets and changing the way others think by putting themselves on the line and changing the course of history? And we're not making this up. This is an emergency, and it needs to be fought, and there's no other way it's going to be changed. There's nobody in power who's going to stop it for you. They have no interest in it, and their track record proves it. And so you have to get out, and you have to be part of doing the work to resist this.
All right. That was Sansara Taylor, revolutionary communist writer for Revolution Newspaper and RevCom.us. You can hear the entire interview at themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, it's my website, themichaelslateshow.com, and the entire interview will be posted up there. So check that out. All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I'd like to thank my guests, Dawn Porter and Sansara Taylor, and all the people who worked on the show. My assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, intern, Alex Brenner, and engineer, Teddy Robinson. And I'd like to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again now, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Talk to you again next week.
To find divorce.